We'll pick up the countdown shortly here. In H-minus 10 seconds, the countdown will come directly from the timing and firing trailer.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
Quantel, opt-in, opt-in, go tape.
This is Publius bringing you A Step Farther Out. Your weekly radio message from the Man and Atom Society. It is Saturday, the 22nd of August in the glorious future year of 2026, and I'm coming to you by pre-recording so that I can go to the stamp show. I was going to do that yesterday, and things just got away from me. Problem being that the stamp show is being held in McKinney, Texas, on the other side of the metro mess, easily an hour and a half drive away. And of course there is no other way to get there, because, as I've often complained, there's very little real in the way of real public transit options, particularly at the intermediate distance scale. I guess I could, in principle, drive the car downtown. There is a bus which might take me downtown if I caught it just right. Then take the train to the airport, then take the... I still don't think I could get to McKinney, is the problem. And it would take me all day. Now, you're going to say, what are you going to do with the stamp show? You know, what do you need more stamps for? You already got a whole suitcase full of stamps. And, of course, part of the answer is, well, they're not all the right stamps. The truth is, right, there's two things. First, I do need some more postage and more postage of different denominations in order to mail things out, if I have things to mail out, which I hope to have soon. I don't know if I've mentioned this, but I went down to the printer the other day and gave him the necessary materials so that I'm going to have professionally printed mailers for the coin cards. Now, in the past, what I've done is used the laser printer to print on cardstock and then used a razor knife to cut slits in it to hold the card, right? Which is thick. You know, it's a millimeter and a half, 2 millimeters thick. I have gone to the printer, and he's going to do two things for me. First, you know, so he's only going to print the outsides, because the insides of the mailers, I figure I'm going to have to print different text on them depending what I'm going to put in them, right? That's going to evolve, particularly as I get more than one different kind of medallic art item to include in the cards, okay? But the outside, so the text will be in black, and then the art panel lying behind the text in a metallic silver, and then all this on a blue card. But the other important thing is that he's going to drill holes in the card so that I can then just take a pair of scissors and snip between those holes and then put the card in. And this will be much easier than trying to deal with the slit cutting and the wiggling and jiggling the corners of the card into the slits to hold it. So all of that will be of benefit. All that will be to the best. Anyhow, so those are things that I hope to need to mail out. Again, if you want a coin card, then they are available, right? Firstly, they're available to subscribers at the $5 level of my Patreon campaign, right? Patreon.com/man_and_Atom. But if you can find some other way to get me $5 or the equivalent, and yes, I will accept a 5-euro note or a 5-pound note by mail, then I will be happy to mail you one of these. You know, equally, you can go to paypal.me/PrometheusLives and send me $5, and make sure to include your mailing address in the notes field so I know where to send it. And a little note saying, please send me a coin card, and if you have a preference on color. Now, most of them are going to have the U.S. 3-cent Adams for Peace stamp, postage stamp, right? Because the whole way the cards are set up, there's a coin, the Greek 10 drachma coin with the Adams symbol on one side and the imaginary portrait of Democritus on the other, and then the postage stamp. And most of these will have the U.S. 3-cent Adams for Peace stamp. But I have some other options. One of these options is the Canadian 5-cent stamp showing the Douglas Point nuclear power plant, the first full-scale CANDU plant. And then there are some others. There's some British ones, for example, that I hope to get a few more specimens of. Anyway, so if you have a preference, and of course there's a U.S. 20-cent stamp from the Knoxville World's Fair, which says Breeder Reactor, and it's got a kind of a hex grid pattern on it. So yeah, if you have a preference for that, if you have a preference for the color of the card, because I got them in all colors, right? I've got several different blues, maroon, purple, red, fuchsia, pink, orange, yellow. I got lots of colors. I have decided to give up on the metallics, though, because what I found was the stamps do not stick very well to the gold and silver metallics. After a while, the stamp, in a lot of cases, just falls right off. So I've decided to give up on those for the moment. May revisit them later, but anyway. So yeah, I need to get myself some more 3-cent Adams for Peace stamps. Need to get myself some more of those 5-cent atomic energy stamps from Canada. Need to get myself some more of those 20-cent stamps. They come in a pane of 4, fossil fuels, synthetic fuels, solar energy, and breeder reactors. And I can use 3 out of the 4 just as regular postage, which helps. And then the breeder reactors ones can go on coin cards, or they can go on badges or magnets. I also want to see if I can get some more of those Hungarian space stamps and some more of the Romanian ones that are, well, if I say they're diamond-shaped, what I really mean is that they are square, but the upright is the diagonal of the square. The vertical axis of the stamp is the diagonal of a square. Anyway, I got one in a grab bag of space-themed stamps, grab envelope, and it had Yuri Gagarin. Anyway, it turns out there's a whole series of these, and the Romanians, not being firmly in the Soviet orbit as much as, say, Hungary or Poland, issued a whole series of them in 1964 with the early astronauts and cosmonauts, both. So there's, you know, John Glenn and Scott Carpenter and Valentina Tereshkova. And I like that a lot. And so I'm thinking of getting some of those if I can get them at a reasonable price. You know, I'm not going to pay $1.50 a piece for them. But considering that I got some in a grab envelope. You know, and then there's United Nations atomic energy stamps and other atomic energy stamps. Anyway, so there's some that I want for art projects and some that I want for postage. That's the real basic consideration. So I hope to have more things to mail out. I am still working on blast number 3, right? And that's going to call for postage. I've got the cover design done, which is good. Anyhow. So that's something. All right, that keeps you apprised of my current activities, more or less. I have, as I mentioned, temporarily rejoined the Dallas Makerspace, and I am trying to make progress on building my coinage press. Also, I may be in the Dallas-Fort Worth area until fairly late in October and take that chance. So National Nuclear Science Week is like the 19th through the 23rd of October this year. And so to do a Saturday or Sunday program at one end of that week, and then regular programs during the week, my Introduction to Atomic Energy lecture series at DMS. We'll see if we can make that work, because I'd really like to do that. What else? I've been thinking about energy and electrification. You know, at the Eurocon, I had a conversation with science fiction author Charlie Strauss, who was feeling very upbeat about renewables and battery electric cars, saying, well, you know, the prices of solar have come down, so it pays people to put, you know, solar on their roofs in Britain. But this isn't actually contributing much in any real way to solve the energy problems in Britain. And it, again, it doesn't help you at all if you don't live in at least a semi-detached house. Now, I do find it odd that in Britain, people who are saying, well, we need, for example, in London, we need more, we don't need just single and two-bedroom places, we need three and four-bedroom places because families are leaving London because they can't find a place to live, are saying, oh, stop building all these high-rises. Well, there's nothing that says a high-rise can't have three and four-bedroom flats in it. You know, a three or four-bedroom living space does not have to be a detached or semi-detached house. But regardless, when I was in New York City, I noticed some ads for, quote, generative AI, which were baffling to me. And I want to bring this up because generative AI, right, is the rationale being given. A couple of years back, it was cryptocurrency, but that didn't work so well. Cryptocurrency and NFTs, that just didn't work out. And so instead, the people trying to push more and more and more investment into building more and more data centers are using generative AI as a rationale. Now, let me be clear, you know, the way I'm talking, you're saying, but are you saying that the data centers themselves are the intended end outcome? And yes, that is exactly what I'm saying. Fundamentally, this is all kind of financial maneuver. As I've said before, it's keeping the money shoveling into the pipeline in order to keep up the illusion of constant growth in an economy which, by most people's standards, is quite stagnant. So, what is this generative AI supposed to do versus what does it actually do, right? And so, in actuality, it seems to me, the main thing that it does is provide an obstacle to any energy transition you're trying to undertake because of the immense electricity demand associated with these data centers. That electricity that they consume is then not available for whatever it is you want to use it for, heat pumps or battery electric cars or whatever. Again, we are in the midst of a serious oil crisis, but one that's entirely, you know, was entirely avoidable, but still, a serious oil crisis, and that doesn't seem to have done much to drive further adoption of battery electric cars. They're still quite stagnant. You know, the Tesla strategy of marketing battery electric cars to car enthusiasts and performance enthusiasts was a good one for building an industry, but as it turns out, there is a saturation point for that. Quite apart from the saturation point of people willing to put up with Elon Musk's particular brand of bullshit, there is a saturation point for the willingness of people to buy cars because they're nifty. For most people, a car is a utilitarian purchase. They buy one because they need one. And boy, I've been down in the midst of needing a car for the last couple of weeks, and I can tell you it isn't much fun. They buy a car because they need one. They buy the car they can afford at the time. And as a result, in a lot of cases, they're not buying battery electrics. And it doesn't help that the suppliers of battery electric cars, in many cases, are trying to make what has been described as a smartphone on wheels. Because I would say that a lot of people, even people who are enthusiastic about smartphones, realize that there's a great difference between a smartphone and a car. For what you pay for a car, you want it to last 20 years, and also you don't want to have to be doing constant software updates. Imagine they push a software update while you're driving around that makes the brake system not work. That would be what we call a problem. And it's absolutely something that can happen. You know, if Microsoft can push an update to millions and millions of computers that causes them to delete your files, then whatever company is providing software updates for your car can absolutely push an update that will cause the braking system to stop working. But as I've said, you know, there are other obstacles to uptake, such as, where are the chargers? How do people living in apartments who don't have garage space, right, who are sharing a communal parking lot, how do they charge their battery electric cars? It's unclear. But the whole thing gets a lot worse if you have then to deal with the competition, right, the competing electricity demand of these giant data centers. Put entirely to one side the energy required for manufacturing the servers, which in many cases is greater than the servers themselves will consume during their operating lifetime. Just consider the operating power demand, and we start to have a problem, again, because the electric generating capacity is difficult to expand overnight. You know, people talk about, oh, well, solar and wind are quick to install. Each individual unit may be quick to install, but as far as adding overall generation to the grid, they do so only slowly. Whereas nuclear power units, although they take a long time, they don't have to take nearly as much time as you have been seeing, certainly, but 3 to 5 years is a reasonable figure. For a, you know, 500 to 1500 megawatt nuclear generating unit, 3 to 5 years is a reasonable figure, and that makes a big bump in the availability of power. Still in all, although the projected demand for electricity from data centers is getting people interested in building more nuclear power plants, which is all to the good, the fact is these are sinks for electricity. That what are they producing of value in return for what's flowing into them? And so when I was in New York recently, I saw some interesting ads. Interesting in the sense that they made me say, whoa, Nelly, no. And what am I talking about? Well, first there was an ad claiming that their AI system would provide you with a fully autonomous, artificially intelligent software engineer. That you can just tell the thing, oh, I need a program to do X, or I need a web platform to do Y, and it would put together all the pieces for you. I just have really severe doubts that any kind of engineering could be done in this way. I think that, to tell the truth, the only reason they're able to get away with calling this software engineering is that, to a great extent, the term software engineering is used for a lot of activities which I would not recognize as engineering at all. Maybe I'm a little bit of a snob, but it seems to me that for something to be engineering, it has to be auditable. Somebody else has to be able to come in and figure out, okay, what is this? How does it work? What does it do? Take it down to its constituent parts and rebuild it. If you're not doing that, right, if you can't do that, then it just isn't engineering. It's some other kind of activity entirely. And software engineering as a whole is bad about that, but something created in a fully autonomous system where nobody ever sees what's being done is going to be a lot worse. You know, just coding, producing lines of code, is not the same as engineering. Vibe coding is sure as hell not the same as engineering, and fully autonomous software engineering is an oxymoron. But to explain why, it might be good to discuss this other ad that I saw, which was telling you, oh yes, you're going to use AI to do your presentations in your business. And they showed this, the traditional long and winding road that takes you hours and hours to put together your slide deck and starts with research, pulling together citations, doing a draft, doing layout, putting in your charts, doing polish, then you have finished slides. Instead, it says, oh, yeah, it's got a straight path where you just give it a prompt at one end, the slides come out at the other. And it's like, okay, so if you're skipping the step where you do research, and you're skipping the step where you do outlining, firstly, how in the world do you have any confidence that the slides output as a result of the prompt have anything to do with what you want? How do you know that the information presented on them is anything resembling factual? How do you know that the structure of the presentation implied by the slides you get as a result of the prompt actually reflects the presentation you want to make, right? The research and outlining steps are where the meat of it is. This is not much better than just having a stranger hand you a deck of slides and then requiring you to build a presentation around them, which is a thing that gets done as a kind of party trick. Literally, there's a sort of a game involving exactly that, where, you know, you get a deck of 10 slides, which may be random or may have been prepared for some purpose you're unfamiliar with, and then you have 10 minutes to do a presentation based on them, sort of sight unseen. Anybody who thinks that this is something that you should be doing in a serious context rather than as a joke needs their head examined. So yeah, this is the SpaceX IPO, which put 1% of the valuation on the space launch business and 3% of the valuation on the ComSat business and 96% of the valuation on XAI with an alleged addressable market of $37.5 trillion. It assumes a utility assumes that people pay money for something, presumably because they have a use for it, without demonstrating any kind of utility for the thing that supposedly is to be paid for. And the arguments that are being made by the people who are trying to sell it are far from convincing. So I just wanted to sort of put that bug in your ear. Now, I'm going to talk about this more later. Among my late grandmother's many books, I found a book, very interesting book, called The Pentagon of Power by Lewis Mumford, which is part of a series called The Myth of the Machine. So the first volume of The Myth of the Machine was Technics and Human Development. The second volume is The Pentagon of Power. Other books include The Story of Utopias, 1922, Technics and Civilization, 1934, The Culture of Cities, 1938, The Condition of Man, 1944, City Development, 1945, Values for Survival, 1946, Art and Technics, 1952, The Transformation of Man, 1956, The City and History, 1961, The Highway and the City, 1963, The Urban Prospect, 1968. So that gives you an idea of Mumford's sort of fields of interest, although he also did a biography of Herman Melville. Anyway, there's a great deal of what I would call serious negativity in this volume, although there are some equally interesting... He makes a lot of interesting points. I'll just say that. He makes a lot of interesting points. Many of them I don't agree with. But as I have often said, it's worthwhile reading people you don't agree with in order to better formulate your own position. But he is... For example, he refers to the original World Trade Centers in New York as a pointless gigantism, an expression of a society gone mad. Now, I have a serious quarrel with the original World Trade Center in New York, but it's certainly not Mumford's quarrel. My quarrel is this. There used to be a place in the United States completely comparable to Akihabara in Tokyo, maybe even better than Akihabara in Tokyo, a place where you could go to find all kinds of bits and bobs of equipment, a paradise for innovators and inventors, not one of these fake plastic innovation incubators set up at a university or a corporate campus, but a real place where people could go and find bits to tinker on. Best in the world. Radio Row on the lower west side of Manhattan. In fact, I remember reading a science fiction novel set in the 22nd century where people have need parts to repair their malfunctioning robot, and they go to Radio Row. Or they need parts for a spaceship, and they go to Radio Row, New York City. Well, that was demolished to make way for the World Trade Center towers. And I'll never forgive the Port Authority for that. You know, they thought, oh, urban renewal, we need to get rid of all these messy little shops and things. Well, those messy little shops and things were the incubators of technological advancement. You get rid of them, what do you get? Stagnation. I'm not a big fan of stagnation. I'm also not a big fan of an environment in which, if you want to innovate, you have to do it in a press-formed corporate context. So yeah, I do think we lost something important with the demolition of Radio Row. But I don't think that skyscrapers are useless gigantism, an expression of a kind of tumor-forming complex of society. The fact is we know now, and Mumford is very negative about this, I think, but we know now that humans have been trying to form cities since before it was possible. That we always used to attribute the creation of cities to the development of agriculture, but it's become clear, archaeology has made it clear in recent years, that this just isn't so. That people were trying to come together in large groups persistently for much longer than we've had agriculture. Because there are massive cultural advantages in having lots of people in the same place. You get Adam Smith's division of labor. You also get the ability to do things that just aren't feasible when people are more spread out because of the time it takes to get from one person to the next. And so even in the period of many, many centuries when your life expectancy was drastically less in the cities than in the countryside, people constantly flocked to cities. And giant buildings are an outgrowth of the pressure of people crowded into cities. That's all. Anyway, send your cards and letters to Post Office Box 1035, Fort Worth, Texas 76101, United States of America. I'll probably send you something in return. I'll probably read what you have to send me on the show. And of course, you can send me money by way of encouragement. And if you don't want to send wads of cash by mail, paypal.me/prometheuslives, patreon.com/man_and_adam for a recurring contribution.